In the way that these things work with England, it'll turn out that it was never actually abolished.
It's still the Charles becomes king,
yeah,
and he demands payment.
This concludes the audio test.
Yeah, yeah. Great way to start the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did any of you see the latest trailer and now the credit sequence for The Expanse coming to sci-fi?
No.
December? Okay.
I don't think so.
Trailer, somewhat interesting title credit scene. I'm kind of done with long title credit scenes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the age where you watch everything on Netflix, so something that occurs to me, really watching something like House of Cards that has that kind of lengthy credit scene. You know, I'm sitting here, I'm going to watch this whole season today. I'm done hearing this title music for the 25th time. Long title sequences, done.
I love the House of Cards title sequence.
It's great.
It'd be good to have whenever you're binging on it, whenever you're in your horrible cave of desperation, mm-hmm, and all the lights are off and you're just watching, you know, 24 hours of television. It'd be great to have a skip feature on that. But
I think
to
Arrow
start
has
it off,
down.
It works.
Yeah, Arrow has it down. They do the sting, and then they do the da-da-da-da-da, and then straight into the episode. But no, the trailer looks... You know, I read the books this summer, knowing that they were doing the adaptation.
Yes.
The trailer looks like it's going to be a fun show. It's not going to have anything to do with the books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's okay. That'll probably be fine. I saw that they're also doing a mini-series of Childhood's End, which I think will probably also not necessarily terribly faithful to the book. Looks like it's going to be a bit boring TV. I'm in favor of good quality sci-fi adaptations, even if the... I've not read the Game of Thrones books, and I don't watch the show, but if you told me that the show is not faithful to the books, I don't think that would make much difference. People say it's a really good show.
It's surprisingly faithful, considering, and you know, the differences have enough people screaming that it does make a difference. I have an issue whenever a show extremely deviates from a book, especially like in movies and stuff like that. The thing that I think of is Blade Runner, which I read the book first before I saw the movie.
Do Androids
Dream of Electric Sheep? And it's a wonderful book. Very convoluted, as everything he writes is. But it's a wonderful book. And I go to watch the movie, and I'm like, where's his wife? Where's the sheep? Where's the quasi-religious thing that all humans are following that are really actually androids? None of this is in the movie.
Yeah, where's Hypnotoad?
Exactly. And please retitle it. Mm. You know, call it something else if you're going to do that.
Which, in fairness, they did.
Yeah, but then, they call it Blade Runner, but then, like, the book has Blade Runner, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Yeah.
I think that may have been a super title added later. The original was just... Yeah. Dickens seems to have contributed a lot of DNA to movies, but they never take the whole organism. They just take a few little strands of DNA and run with that. I can understand the logic of that, because Larry Niven is very good at creating worlds and interesting concepts, and then running out of ideas of things to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of his short stories are really, really good, because they're just concise little nuggets. But then something like Ringworld kind of peters out about halfway through, or at least kind of drags, because it just seems like he's lost really a sense of what to do with this enormous landscape. Although, speaking of Ringworld, your Dyson Sphere from episode 5, I think, doesn't seem to be panning out.
So what it turns out is that, surprise, surprise, the Dyson Sphere isn't sending out a giant signal that says, come here, eat at Joe's. You know, if I was an alien race building a Dyson Sphere, I wouldn't set off a beacon out in all directions either. doesn't seem like a smart idea.
Right.
So, it's probably not a Dyson sphere. It's probably something really, really boring, like comet clouds or something really stupid. But it's very, very possible, you know, it still could be a Dyson sphere.
Keeping the dream alive.
Keeping the dream alive, you know. The truth is out there.
So what you're saying here, Mike, is that only human beings would be stupid enough to broadcast their position to potentially hostile alien races.
Well,
and reveal lots of important details about their culture at the same time.
Well, it's...
Isn't this the premise of the movie Pixels?
I think that, you know, it's quite possible that in 200 years... we're no longer going to be broadcasting. At least in the sense, like, in 200 years, we wouldn't be able to, with our technology, pick up what we will be producing in 200 years. I think that we're going to have communications in such a way they're going to be fully encrypted, and they're going to be encrypted in such a way that you won't be able to detect it.
This is the quantum state communication.
Exactly, the quantum state communication. And if they're building a Dyson sphere, then they probably have something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, just because there's not a signal doesn't mean the aliens aren't there, but they probably aren't, unfortunately. Or fortunately. It depends on how you look at it.
Well, if they are there, I hope at some point we can all meet at the restaurant at the end of the universe.
Yes, yes. Say hi to the dog.
I have some good steaks.
That's a very disturbing illusion. I remember that scene.
You remember that scene? Okay. Yeah.
Was that in the movie? I know that they kind of meshed up the first three books for the movie.
Right. I
vaguely remember that movie.
I don't recall if they had the scene with the cow at the restaurant at the end of the universe in that movie, but I do remember really enjoying Alan Rickman.
Yes.
As Marvin the Paranoid Android. Yeah. That was fantastic. That was so well cast.
It was the only highlight of...
I have all five of the books sitting up there on my bookshelf right now.
He is probably what formed my impression of what good sci-fi writing is. Mm-hmm. Or what good writing
yes.
is. And so, you know, it's no surprise to me that having grown up on Douglas Adams, that Joss Whedon was appealing to me, because there's that same kind of somewhat arch, somewhat sarcastic, zippy character to it.
Definitely. So, are we going to talk about our beer this evening?
Yeah,
I mean, we don't have any pan-galactic gargle blasters.
No.
But we do have some beer.
All out at Basler's. What do you know? I am drinking an oatmeal stout by Breckenridge Brewery. It's very good. I enjoy it. It says dark and dreamy, and I think that's it.
It's musty.
Yeah, and prior to that, you had tried another beverage.
Yes, I tried the Stella Artois cider, and that was excellent. Very, very good.
Yeah, that was probably the best cider I've ever had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also had started with a Breckenridge Breck IPA. I found one, an Urban Wheat Ale by 312 from the Goose Island Beer Company. I should explain that the reason why we're having two this time around isn't because we're alcoholics, but because we just recorded another podcast before this one. And so we're kind of doubling up.
Well, that's the rationale. You know,
yes.
The reason isn't just because we're alcoholics.
Okay.
Yeah. So I too had two beers. And I started with a Lagunitas little sum.
Oh, I see what you're on there. That's pretty good.
And that's actually one of my favorite ales. The next thing that I had, which is totally not in that vein, is a coffee milk stout from Stone.
Which sounds fantastic.
And confessedly, I am not a huge fan of Stone's beers, generally.
Really?
My first introduction to Stone was the Arrogant Bastard Ale, which I don't know what this says about me in light of the Arrogant Bastard thing, but I didn't think it was good enough.
I think that says everything.
I like that, and I do for special occasions tend to pick up exactly that, because it comes in a larger bottle, and I'm trying to build up a collection of somewhat larger bottles, but smaller than the 32-ounce, you know, sort of main guns on the USS Iowa ones that I have for home brewing that I've used for a few years now, because the 32-ounce one's really hard to stay out of control.
So you're not a fan of growlers?
What's a growler?
It's a big jug. You can buy beer in these big jugs.
I mean, if I could get hold of a couple of those, then that would, you know, that would be probably good. I'd probably try just home brewing in those. The first batch of homebrew I did, I used essentially recycled Sam's bottles, and these 12-ounce bottles. And as annoying as it is to drink out of a 12-ounce bottle and have to go back and forth to the fridge, just wait till you try decanting into them out of a 5-gallon thing. And so yeah,
I'd probably skip a step there and just drink out of the 5-gallon.
Well, no, you've got to. It's not that. Ask David about that.
I mean, I realize you'd have to have two arms, you know.
Yeah, that's not going to work. But I do like the stone, and I appreciate the size bottle it comes in, because I'm building up kind of a reserve army. And that's a good size. You know, one of the downsides of growing up in Britain is that you get very used to the notion that beer comes in units of pints. And so a 12-ounce thing is really unsatisfying on a right. very visceral level.
Correct.
Right? It's a bit total alky.
He just wants more alcohol.
That's right. Well, honestly, I would be perfectly happy to drink non-alcoholic beer if you could get a non-alcoholic beer that tasted any good.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
I've tried O'Doul's. And it was passable. I mean, it was sort of like Budweiser. It had that drinkability going for it.
We really should play a prank on a fraternity and switch out their Budweiser with O'Doul's.
Would they not happen?
Yeah.
I don't know that I really want to spend money on a fraternity.
I'd spend money just to see what would
happen.
Just
to see them not get drunk?
Just to see them not get drunk, but to think they're drunk.
But think they're drunk, of course, yes.
You just slap the Budweiser label on the
I'm curious, deck. Like if this was a big party and they had some girls over, would they still have beer goggles? You know, even with the non-alcoholic beer,
there we go.
This would be interesting. Yes,
I think we need to have a control group and an experimental group.
Clearly. I think we need to call the social sciences department.
Yes.
Point.
Maybe we can get funding from the National Institute for something or another.
Yeah.
Health.
Yeah.
Definitely health.
Yeah, health. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. To study.
So I wasn't sure what we were going to talk about first, but I think we're on the campus thing. So you want to talk about the free speech issues on campus thing? That seems like a natural segue from frats to campus speech codes.
It does. Certainly it's been something that's discussed on a lot of college campuses right now for obvious reasons. And I think we need to understand that there are actually two different kinds of things going on right now that intersect. So there are events at Yale, for example, and other institutions as well, but events at Yale in which a master living in a residence hall has basically sent an email out saying, hey, you know, if people have Halloween costumes that you may find offensive, you know, we can deal with it as adults. We can engage in free speech and discussion and engage with each other. And we may want to consider that not every instance of somebody wearing a costume is of cultural appropriation and these sorts of things, while also recognizing that sometimes they are. And admittedly, I find some costumes pretty tasteless myself. Both on grounds of cultural appropriation and other grounds.
Wait, wait, so you buy into the cultural appropriation piece? That kind of bothers you?
Sometimes. It depends on how it's done.
Mm-hmm.
I think I don't have an issue with, for example, engaging in a costume that is, you know, a trope within a culture. For example, if I were to dress up as a member of a mariachi band and, you know, have that as a costume. I don't see any particular problem with that as a costume. What I probably would have a problem with is somebody dressing up in a sombrero and a poncho and saying, I'm going as a Mexican. And I realize that's a pretty fine distinction to make. But the one is taking a kind of a legitimate cultural trope and mm-hmm. saying, I'm going to be going as this kind of person. Mm-hmm. And the other is just playing to inaccurate stereotypes and being lazy.
When I was a kid, you could collect a sufficient number of gem jar lids and get a gollywog pin badge, which were a collection of black, big-eyed, stick figure-like things with an afro. Obviously, a kid in England in the 80s, they didn't know what an afro was. I hadn't yet seen any blaxploitation movies, and so it just wasn't something that was part of my life. In hindsight, you look at these things and go, boy, where had I possibly not realized? But, you know, and they would be wearing various uniforms, and so you would have the fireman gollywog, the policeman gollywog, probably not the Indian gollywog, for, you know, you can get the village people set going, but, you know, and all these kinds of things going on. So that, I see, you know, if I dressed up as a gollywog for Halloween, I would see why that would be offensive. I wouldn't classify it under cultural appropriation. It just wouldn't be a very good Halloween costume. Halloween, you're supposed to dress up as a superhero or a fireman or a policeman. We saw a lot of policemen this year for Halloween. It was kind of interesting.
Well, you know, some people do see them as scary.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know quite how to describe it, but I wouldn't categorize that as cultural appropriation.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Isn't it a little bit, cultural appropriation, a little more complex than that?
Yeah, I mean,
yes, it's a category of convenience in a lot of ways.
Okay, yeah.
There's this ever-widening definition of cultural appropriation. Mm. But your prototypical example would be somebody like Iggy Azalea,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, started out as a fairly typical pop singer and kind of made an interesting shift to doing a lot of hip-hop kinds of things, you know, mm-hmm. had head surgeries to modify her appearance, got a significantly darker skin tone somehow, I'm assuming that involved tanning beds, and then started producing this kind of music, I'm assuming specifically to make money. My guess is that was what the record company wanted. Was, hey, we see an opportunity here. This is where the market's going. We need you to fit into this niche market where we can make some money. And so that sort of thing would be kind of a typical example of cultural appropriation, where you basically appropriate the cultural forms of a certain cultural subset of society and then make money off of it pretty shamelessly.
What's the difference between that and John Mayall and Eric Clapton in the 1960s?
Not much. Or Elvis, for example.
Mm-hmm. Elvis is a great example because there's more of it, because Elvis wasn't just a singer but a performer.
No. Although, you know, to be fair, Elvis actually gave a lot of credit to the people he mm-hmm. Was influenced by.
Well, and so did Clapton. And yeah. Sure, Mayall did the same.
Yeah, I don't really see Iggy Azalea doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think cultural appropriation is a thing, and strictly speaking, it's the correct term to use. But I don't see it being as this blanket, horrible thing in all cases. I mean, the United States is cultural appropriation.
Right, we're a nation of immigrants.
Yeah, you know.
And cultural melting pot.
I'm part Irish. Should I be mad at all the non-Irish taking part in St. Patrick's Day? That's cultural appropriation.
I'm appropriating your culture right now,
you
sir.
You are appropriating my culture. Stop.
Let me take another drink of your culture.
You know, Chinese food is horrible, horrible cultural appropriation.
Oh my gosh, Chinese food is...
How is that cultural appropriation?
Because they're taking... Chinese food here in the United States, I'm using air quotes, you guys can't see that, isn't Chinese food.
Okay.
Like, you go over to China, and they'll have no idea what the crack Kung Pao chicken is. They don't know.
They may have heard of General Tso, but
yeah, they don't know about his chicken,
right?
But what's interesting is that's cultural appropriation done by Chinese immigrants to appeal to, you know, the white people of
right.
the United States.
Yeah, you probably aren't going to find the Lucky Eight China buffet in Taiwan.
Probably not. Or if you do, it's because someone moved back to Taiwan and decided to open up one right outside the airport.
Yeah, right where the Westerners
yeah,
come
right,
in.
Yeah, right Gullible next Westerners to the only right Holiday Inn in Taiwan.
I guess I'm still fuzzy on why that's cultural appropriation rather than... why is that cultural appropriation? I'm still fuzzy on this concept. I don't get it.
It's okay. It's okay. We just need to re-educate you.
Okay.
Yes. We have a camp.
Tulsi camp! Tulsi
yes,
camp!
Yes. Yeah. It's actually a camp us.
Yes.
Oh, you can go to one and get re-educated. So anyway, back to the campus thing. The issue of...
That was a handbrake turn of a segue, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Whiplash, it's okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I hit the brakes pretty hard there. Sorry about that. The Yale issue started over cultural appropriation, and there was an interesting exchange between some of the students and one of the professors living in the hall, who's there to kind of facilitate their academic lifestyle. And one of the students, who's apparently not normally known for this sort of thing, had a bit of an outburst, and apparently decided that, you know, we shouldn't listen to this person. We should refuse to hear his views. And I thought that was a bit worrying, because the express purpose of higher education is to expose you to other views, to get you accustomed to engaging with other views, to think critically about other views, and to expose you to experiences that you might not otherwise have.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's your mentality about university experience, I'm a little concerned that you may not have got the point. Mm-hmm. And aside from that, the calls to censor people who say things that we don't like, or get them fired, that's also very worrying, because even though we have free speech in our Constitution, what does it matter if in practice you can be fired for offending mm-hmm. anyone?
Right. There's always been a broader complementary norm that goes along with mm-hmm. the First Amendment.
Right. You have to continue that tradition of personal liberty mm-hmm. In addition to what's on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worrying to me that we're eroding that. Because from my perspective, it is far better for people I completely disagree with, neo-Nazis, for example, to be able to speak their views and for me to have the opportunity to counter those views than to shut them down, have them go underground, have their resentments build, and then their views never get heard. I tend to agree with Mike, who said in a previous podcast that he wants his Nazis right where he can see them.
Exactly.
I want them to be able to make themselves known. You know, I want us to be aware that there are still people like that out there. And part of that's for a reason that I'm sure people who like speech codes will understand very well, which is that I don't want us to pretend that racism is gone.
Mm.
No, I don't want us to pretend that this stuff is completely over, that it's been eradicated, that we've all arrived in some sort of, you know, grand post-racial society where everybody's enlightened, because that's just not true.
Right.
You know, I'd rather that fact be out there and be known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which brings me to the other thing at Mizzou, where there were incidents of racism. As far as I can tell, those accounts are genuine.
Mm-hmm.
Where they experienced issues of racism, and the school administration didn't respond to them in a way that they thought was appropriate. And as far as I can tell, sometimes I agree with them, sometimes I don't. But that was a genuine issue of racism. And the problem I see is that these two kinds of things intersect in a really difficult way. You have the coddled college student who can't deal with opposing views,
mm-hmm.
and you have the college student who's got a legitimate grievance about racism on campus
mm-hmm.
that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, those two things are being lumped into the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're seeing is people on the left who really sympathize with the complaints about racism saying, well, this is all genuine instances of oppression. And we need to treat all of this as oppression. And this free speech stuff is just sort of this chimera out here being used by the right. And then you have people who are more conservative saying, well, this is all just your coddled college student nonsense. And kind of ignoring this genuine instance of racism over here and not dealing with it as a separate issue. Mm-hmm. So that there's a certain ideological blindness that's keeping us from being able to disentangle these two different problems.
I say, can I suggest for sake of argument that we assume that the Mizzou claims really are legitimate issues? I don't know if they are, but if they aren't, because honestly we don't really care about Mizzou, sorry Mizzou. You know. You're important only insofar as you're an example of a class. But I'm sure there is a class of genuine racial incidents that happen in colleges. And I think that's the distinction you're trying to draw. So we should probably just assume that the complaints of Mizzou.
And I do. Legit. And you know, I can't speak to speak to things that I've seen personally, because I work for a university and that probably wouldn't be appropriate on a podcast. Mm-hmm. But. I mean, I can tell you I've seen things personally that were incidents of genuine racism.
Yeah, I mean, with the Mizzou case, there are some things that have a lot of credence. People being shouted racial epithets, that sounds real to me. There's other things. There's a thing with the swastika and...
Yeah, the poop swastika?
Yeah, the poop swastika.
I believe that was weird.
I don't, because this is going to sound odd, but there is no pictures of the poop swastika.
Which seems odd age of mobile phones.
No one took a photo of it. Mm-hmm. And whenever I hear someone drew a swastika, I get suspicious. Because I'm not saying every case of a swastika is fake, but there is a high incidence rate of people faking swastikas. But Even so, I mean, the cases of them shouting racial slurs, that's troubling. But I think that especially students overestimate the abilities of administrators to effectively deal with that.
Yeah, one of my lawyer friends posted a piece by one of the professors at Mizzou who wanted to express their support of the students in this kind of difficult situation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he mentioned is that, you know, as a person who supports them, he had to advise them that under the law, given the First Amendment protections we have, what the school administrators can do about these things is very limited. You know, there's not a whole lot they can do, and that these incidents probably can't be dealt with that way. Mm-hmm. And it's sad because, you know, none of us thinks that's appropriate. And none of us think that's right at all. And certainly I would hope that over the next 100 years or so, we could grow out of that sort of thing, mm-hmm. at least partially. Not that I think it'll ever be gone, because there are normal human cognitive biases at play and cultural traditions at play. Mm-hmm. But hopefully it's not nearly as big of a problem.
Let me play devil's advocate a little, just to kind of attack your distinction between the two different kinds of situation. So, say at Mizzou, someone, a white student yelled at a black Jewish student, you know, Hitler should have killed you all. I wish he'd succeeded. Across the quad. Why is that different to a student in a much more academic tone, presenting that as a viewpoint? In a studiously neutral third-person context, I rather feel that it would have been better had Hitler succeeded in completing the Final Solution, and so on and so forth. Why are these two things differently, given that in both cases there's a pretty good chance that someone is going to hear these things and perceive it as being personal? You know, we tend to talk about things in a quite academic way, and I do believe that it is different, but have a devil of a time explaining why it's different. If the criterion is, if someone takes offense, then that's actionable.
Well, I don't know that that's the criterion. I actually don't see a lot of difference between those two things.
Okay.
I mean, they're both instances of protected speech to me.
I mean, the first instance could be construed as a threat.
It's more likely to be construed as a threat.
It's the first instance is someone directing speech at someone else. I would construe that as possibly a threat, and I'd be okay with campus police talking to that person.
I'd be
okay with perhaps pursuing some school disciplinary measures. The second instance is someone speaking in broader tones, and it's really, really disturbing, and we should keep an eye on them, but that person shouldn't be subject to disciplinary.
So
measures.
So long as it's not directed at a specific person, is that the criteria?
That's a criteria. That's where I draw. If it's directed at a specific person, we can take very concrete and discreet steps. If it's more general, then we scale things back. That's how I would draw it.
Yeah, I guess I'm more of a civil libertarian, and I immediately see those as both instances of protected speech. Horrifying speech is much of protected speech is, but still protected speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think those kinds of instances are why people are having trouble separating the two kinds of phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And why it's so difficult for us to deal with it. Because we simply can't disentangle the idea that people can take offense to anything and that's a very serious problem, just someone taking offense to something. And genuinely troubling kinds of statements.
Mm-hmm.
And not every statement is genuinely troubling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How far is it different to say, this piece of art that you've created is so offensive that I'm going to stick a knife in your throat, versus this thing that you've said is so troubling and offensive that I'm going to stick a fork in your career? Is there some kind of convergence here between these two kind of liberal tendencies toward, you have offended me, and so I am going to, there are going to be reprisals against you that are going to be enormously detrimental to you. I don't want to oversell that comparison, but I don't want to undersell it either, because if you've gone to, there are cases where teachers have gone into enormous debt to qualify as teachers, anticipating that they will have a career as teachers, and then have been fired for some minor infraction.
Stephen Salida?
I don't.
That's a recent case.
Yeah, but you see what
he won his lawsuit.
Okay.
But, I see what you mean. In the case of a higher level administrator, I would say there's a significant difference. They're more likely to have the benefits and the retirement package that will ensure that, you know, they can make a living.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of a professor like you're talking about, I worry more about that sort of thing. Not just because the faculty are explicitly engaged in academic exercise,
mm-hmm.
and should have broad academic freedoms, but also because they're more vulnerable to that kind of thing. They tend not to get the same kinds of retirement packages and salaries that the high-level administrators do.
Do we want to disaggregate offense entirely? I mean, what I have in the back of my mind is the Sex Pistols. There's the infamous interview where they went on some talk show and were provoked into cussing, but just because the network wanted them to say something offensive. They were this offensive band from London, therefore let's put them on the television and get them to say something offensive. I have that in the back of my mind, and I also have in the back of my mind that there are some people out there, particularly in the arena of comedy, who feel the need to push the boundary of offensive constantly. So, for example, there's an art installation in Milwaukee at the moment, I think, which is a portrait of Pope Benedict made out of condoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, you know, is offensive, but, you know, it's actually kind of clever. I see the logic of what they're doing there. It's kind of clever. It's certainly offensive. And so I'm aware that there's another side to the story to say this, but why not just say, you know what, if you're offended, tough. Why should our attitude as society just be, if you don't like it, more speech?
Mm-hmm.
The Justice Brandeis solution of that offense is never a sufficient reason for anything to happen. Is that wrong?
Well,
I know you're more likely to say no.
Well, I'm more likely to say no because I'm a civil libertarian.
Right. Yeah.
And I tend to agree with Connor Friedersdorf, who wrote that actually speech codes have traditionally backfired for vulnerable groups on campus.
Mm-hmm.
That they have typically been used as a weapon against the groups that they were intended to protect.
Was it in his piece that we read the story about the Asian lady at Mizzou? Was that a different one?
I don't know if that was his or not.
I don't recall that. There was an Asian lady who made the point that black people can be racists too, and was immediately shouted down and removed. And there was an insinuation that this group that she was in was very happy to hear from an Asian lady to talk about racism until she talked about something that didn't match up with their groupthink view of it, at which point they shouted her down and had her removed from the premises.
No, I don't recall that.
Okay. I don't remember I thought that was in Connor's piece, but
well, Connor's piece did talk about the reporter who was shouted down.
Okay.
Yes, the reporter.
Mizzou,
okay.
Was an Asian American.
Yes, the Asian
student.
Reporter. Yes.
Okay.
So
maybe
that's what you're.
Maybe that's what I'm.
Yeah.
I could be conflating two stories. That happens.
Yeah, there's so many delightful stories about.
I do
free
try
speech.
To do some background reading for the podcast, so I have some idea what's going on.
Yeah, I am generally in favor of giving the most vulnerable people the biggest opportunity we can to have their point of view heard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's people who are economically vulnerable or vulnerable because of issues of racism, you know, whatever it is. I'm generally in favor of very broad free speech protections, because if we don't protect these really annoying Nazi assholes over here, we tend to also erode protections for the people who really need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I find so disturbing about this trend. There's a bunch of people, I mean, we have friends on Facebook who say, you know, screw all of this free speech stuff, that's just a cover for these racist, misogynistic...
Climate deniers.
Yeah.
Right, I think
that's the next thing on the block.
That's a hasty generalization fallacy, generally. Because I think they're right that there are some people who use free speech as a cover to ignore racism and ignore incidents of racism, because those incidents don't fit their narrative about this wonderful post-racial society that we have.
Yeah.
But at the same time, while disagreeing with those people who want to ignore the incidents of racism, I have to say we really don't want to roll back free speech protections, because historically the people who feel that the worst are exactly the people we're trying to protect.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as positively Jacobin. The you know, it's this movement on the left, and I'm not sure how much of it, because it used to be very intentional, this movement where we have rights and you don't, because we're right and you're not.
Error has no rights.
Exactly. The leftist version of that. The idea that, you know, the proletariat is the one that has the rights and has the power, and the bourgeoisie don't have the rights because they're bourgeoisie. And this used to be a very conscious idea and advocated by the left, and they took advantage of the free speech movement in the 60s to get their ideas out there. And now we're seeing that advocated once again, not in terms of proletariat versus bourgeoisie, but in these new categories of racial minorities,
gender
minorities, sexual orientation minorities, having rights, whereas the institution, the quote-unquote majority, doesn't. And I'm not sure how much of that is conscious decision versus an unconscious decision,
It's even more obnoxious because it's not a stable thing, that the sphere of acceptable thoughts is always contracting, whereas at least with Marxism, you had a fairly stable collection of what's an unthinkable thought. Thought crime consisted in supporting the bourgeoisie or opposing the proletariat, but you could think whatever you liked about transgender issues, for example, because it didn't really care, and wasn't likely to start anytime soon. But one of the challenges with the left today is that they always have, if each new day they have a new issue that is of overriding, overwhelming importance. Well, not every day,
almost every other day. They take every other day off and the weekends off.
But what's striking is that whenever they take up an issue, it is with absolute conviction, even though they'd never heard about it yesterday, and with absolute certainty that this is immediately elevated to the pantheon of one of the secular gods that we need to worship and pay mandatory obeisance to.
Yeah. What these kids don't realize is that, you know, whenever you take away my free speech, whenever you take away the free speech of your professor or that college Republican that you find so annoying, you're next. Tomorrow you're going to be on the wrong side of an issue.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, radical feminists are finding that out already.
Yeah, Jermaine Greer is finding that.
Yep. Yeah, I saw the piece about Jermaine Greer, mm-hmm. and that was sad to me because as many disagreements as I'm sure she and I would have, mm-hmm. I think that she should be heard. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to shut down discourse from people who don't agree with me, and my general inclination is the more the merrier.
Yeah, it sounds almost sociopathic, but my general disposition is that we need to force these people to play by the same rules that they want to force other people to play by, because they are actually, literally, sociopaths. They don't have any empathy. They don't connect that if I make these people play by these rules are going to apply to me as well, and I wouldn't feel very happy if I were subject to these rules, like about a cake, for example. And so the only way to illustrate it to them is to force them to play by these rules.
I don't know that it's a lack of empathy. Mm. It's a lack of empathy for people who aren't on their side of the issue.
But that's another way of saying it's a lack of empathy.
Well, it's a selective lack of empathy. Mm-hmm. Meaning that there's plenty of empathy to go around for somebody who's experiencing gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. And wants to change their gender identity. There's lots of empathy there, all kinds of empathy. It's a really very selective kind of empathy, which is odd, but for human beings, not unknown.
Mm-hmm. How do you force them to play by their own rules without destroying our entire system?
Well, therein lies the rub. Yeah. I mean, it's easy when you're talking about cakes, when you're talking about the wedding cakes thing, because you can probably find something that a liberal cake maker finds offensive.
I don't think that would take more than a few seconds.
Yeah, you know, you find someone in Seattle, and you ask them to bake a cake celebrating your daughter's female genital mutilation, and you know they say, "I'm not going to do that," and you sue them, and you forth. But I don't know in the case of speech codes. Mm-hmm. In part because we just don't take offense quite as easily. It's not hard to find a professor who will say something offensive.
I think you could find a good Christian fundamentalist who could take up that cause pretty easily on campus.
That's not my issue.
Somebody who feels very persecuted already.
Yeah, I will have no trouble in doing that. I can pretend to be offended all day long. But my issue is
you've thrown in with the Cruz campaign.
My issue is that in doing that, once I do that and I take down that liberal professor, once I do that and I rub it in their noses, mm-hmm. now I'm dirty. Mm-hmm. Now I've just sawn. I'm sitting on the edge of that branch. Mm-hmm. They're sawing on one side. I'm not going to start sawing on the other side. And that's what you do if you say we're going to make them play by the rules they're proposing. They want to knock they want to cut the tree down.
I mean, there's one they're not going
to. I'm not going to take an axe to the other side of the tree if I want the tree to still be up.
Yeah, it's rather a game of chicken in which you hope that they will stop, realize what's going on and stop.
Yeah, I generally think that not many of us could stand in the winds that blow. If we cut those particular laws down.
It's a nice The only solution is, I think the best solution is to wait them out. They're a brush fire. They're going to burn themselves out. They're going to consume themselves sooner rather than later.
Hopefully. There was a letter. What was that? There was an op-ed, I want to say, by the editorial board of, I want to say, the Mizzou student newspaper, calling out the, well, everyone really, and saying, you have failed this university. The professors have failed it, the students have failed it, the administration has failed it for giving in to the stuff you were describing. And so there is at least the kernel of a backlash.
Well, I think the backlash isn't as loud, but it runs significantly deeper. I think, everything that's going to be remembered out of the Mizzou case, the football players going on strike and forcing an administrator to resign, which is just, whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, that's just amazing and a wonderful display of power. That's not going to be remembered. What's going to be remembered is that little fascist white woman shouting, "This is
a muscle.
I need muscle over here. Find me some muscle to get this poor kid reporter out of public space." Mm-hmm. That's what's going to be remembered, and that's what's going to, douse the movement, because everyone knows that's not right. That's the face of the movement now, unfortunately for its supporters.
It didn't help that she looked like the redheaded girl from that animated movie, the Scottish animated girl who wanted...
Oh, the Brave?
Brave,
yeah.
It's a fast way for us to get sued.
Copyright Disney.
Michael Eisner knows all.
There's actually an all-seeing eye on top of that Disney castle. They just generally hide it, They only break out the eye of Eisner on occasion.
I really hope that when episode 7 opens, that they replace the Disney castle with Palpatine's palace or something.
Oh yeah.
Right? That would be awesome. You don't even have to have Coruscant in the movie. You can just have that little nod to it where you have the open. There have been a few different movies on the Universal stable that have played with that logo.
Mm-hmm.
So the Battlestar postlude, The Plan, quote unquote, had the Universal logo, and instead of Earth, they had Caprica. Oblivion had the Universal logo kind of roll around, and they had the bad guy spaceship. And I think that would be pretty cool.
I want to see a lightsaber in a dance hall. Instead of those glow sticks that people are dancing with, they're dancing with lightsabers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lightsaber chandelier, and it's a floaty chandelier.
Yeah.
It has to be a floaty chandelier.
It has to be a spandelier. I can't even say it. It's a chandelier.
There's an interesting video. This YouTube channel took the prequels and re-edited the prequels and added their own dialogue. It takes the Jedi and turns them from a noble orders to a bunch of stoners. It's
not a stretch.
It's very great. We'll definitely post a link to that in the show notes because it's wonderful. And for the episode one, at the end of episode one, episode one ends with a fight scene between Darth Maul and Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon Jinn, and they turn that into a dance sequence.
Yes,
they take it. They put some techno music to it, and then they cut it in such a way that it makes it look like they're dancing, which is great.
Fair use.
Exactly. Parody.
Yeah.
Parody.
Yeah.
Yep. There is out there someone edited all three of the prequels down to one movie. This has been done a few times, but there's one time that apparently was really, really good. And of course, it was taken down very, very quickly. It's kind of hard to get your hands on.
Apparently, there is going to be a releasing the original theatrical cut, presumably under pressure from the despecialized edition. Someone or team of someone has put together that recreates as close as possible, like they've recolor timed it and used various different sources to put together as close as possible the original theatrical release. Which I've not seen because it's darn difficult to get the download, but I've heard really good things about it and I've seen like snippets of it and it does look really good. But apparently Disney has a different view on this to Lucas, and so they are going to release the original theatrical cut.
You know, Lucas has a quote-unquote vision. Disney sees dollar signs. Absolutely. And here it's that ka-ching.
Yeah, here's another version of this movie we can sell.
Yes.
Yeah.
Give the people what they want.
Yes.
Boy, that's a link to the Sin Otter that ever was. that's the Casper view in a nutshell, isn't it? That's a hell of a segue.
Yeah,
I was about to say,
you think it's the Panem or the Circenses?
I'm sorry.
The bread or the circuses? I used Latin, and you didn't get it, Simon.
This
is a bad night for you, sir.
It is. I didn't hear what you said.
Well, the circus leads up to the bread. Clearly.
That's what I've been saying for a while. That seems to be the goal here, doesn't
well
it?
Well done, Mike. Well done.
Thank you. I mean, a lot of people are in denial about it, but Ross Duffer seems to have woken up, and I just read an interesting piece from Jonathan Last. They're pretty candid in saying that, look, this is what Francis is up to here. This is what his goal is for. There's a lot of people still in denial about it, but it's encouraging to me that more and more people are putting two and two together. But,
oddly, I've read some other commentary that purports to be from a cardinal who said specifically that he had heard from Pope Francis that he wasn't in favor of the Casper proposal, which seems odd. I mean, if he wasn't in favor of the Casper proposal, which, okay, fair enough, I can buy that he's not, then doesn't that suggest that an earlier speculation was true, that maybe he wanted to find a middle way to forge between the Casper proposal and the usual conservative suspects?
Yeah, I think that's how Francis would view it. I think he thinks that he found the middle way. I think that his middle way is bad. I think that it's definitely not ideal.
I've written fairly
it's pretty
extensively
much
on why I don't think that's actually going to be good for families in the way that he wants it to be. I mean, he's well-intentioned about it.
Yeah.
He wants it to be good for families. I just don't think that's actually how it's going to play out.
I don't know. It's just not good. Right. It makes me want to drink some more.
I mean, Duthert thinks that the Synod was a setback for that agenda, whatever it is, but I think you and I, Sam, disagree with that for quite different reasons. You had a piece that disagreed with it on grounds that are not quite the same as mine. You want to talk about that?
Well, I'm going to let you go first, Sam. So why did you disagree with it, since I'm already
on record
in writing?
Well, to be clear about what we're disagreeing with, I don't agree that the Synod was a setback for the agenda, because it is exactly what I expected to come out if the Casper agenda had won completely. I think it's naive to think that you were going to get a document that came out of the Synod that said, oh, by the way, we've changed our mind about all this stuff, and here are the new rules, and blah, 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 blah. That's just not how these people work. It was always going to be, and I would credit the person who proposed this way of thinking about it if I could remember where I'd read it, but I can't. But the strategy that they always use for this kind of thing is always to reaffirm a slightly bolderized version of the previous teaching, and then add the word but, and then give some reason why the earlier version of the teaching should be completely ignored. And you see some of that in the controversial parts of the Relatio, that quote just a specific part from John Paul II, from Aeaus Consortio, but they leave out the really important part. I don't think it actually is quite as on the nose as saying that it actually quotes them and says, but, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. The sum and substance is to quote that this is the general rule, but there are all these other scenarios and considerations and things that we need to keep in mind, and you get this exception swallows the rule problem, that you state the rule in the weakest possible term, and then you add a category of cases that are outside of it that are so large that they eclipse the rule itself.
Sort of like the Friday penance.
Yeah. And so the final Relatio, or at least the controversial part that Rorati had translated, I don't think we have an official English translation of the whole thing yet, but it was basically what I expected, because it provides sufficient cover for Casper, Marx, and people like that to then go out and do whatever they're going to do.
They were going to do anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they were pretty bald about that.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of gets towards your point,
yeah,
after a fashion, because, right, yes, they have said they're going to go off and do what they're going to do anyway, and so it doesn't matter what the synod says. I mean, and your point, as I read it, was that this is really just a ratification of what's already happening.
Yes, in general, what seems to be happening is that people who are divorced and remarried and who don't have a declaration of nullity, mm-hmm, saying that their first marriage wasn't a valid marriage, that they didn't have consent for that marriage, those people are doing one of two things. They're either going to their priest and getting a nod from the priest that says, okay, mm-hmm, I'll commune you, or they're just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not worrying about asking a priest, whether that's because they don't know or because they don't care. I have no idea. But that seems to be what's actually happening from talking to people who are at the ground level dealing with these kind of situations. And so my problem with the Synod was actually that it didn't do much about the situation on the ground. I thought it was kind of shameful that it didn't, because there's actually a lot of need for dealing with family issues in the church, you know, in our hemisphere and in the Eastern Hemisphere. There's a lot of family issues going on that really need a lot of attention, you know. Children starving, you know, domestic violence, adultery, things that we probably should spend time talking about. And instead it turned into this, let's relitigate in the most boring possible way the existing social controversies in the West.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so social controversies that were most recently, what shall I say, hit with a hammer by the Vatican as recently as 2007, the Sacramentum Caritatis, that disposed of the issue, in as Benedict is apt to do, in two paragraphs, you know. And so it's not like we're going back into the ancient prehistory of the 1980s, or God help us, Aquinas.
I'm sorry, who was that again?
Yeah, he was just some guy 800 years ago.
Oh, so pre-Vatican II.
Yeah, he was pre-Vatican II. But you know who else was pre-Vatican II? Jesus. I'm sorry, you know, I know that he sent his personal representative, you know, the Holy Spirit, and she came to Vatican II, but we'll talk more about Vatican II in a minute.
All in all, my impression of the Synod was, it was a missed opportunity,
mm-hmm,
that we wasted a lot of time fighting over things that didn't matter when there were things that really did matter. Mm-hmm.
I mean, your view is fairly compatible with, I know you're not a big podcast listener, but the 1 Peter 5 podcast had a guest talking about the Synod and the family, and his position was fairly close to yours, that, you know, this was something we should have had a Synod on the family, and the one that we actually had was a missed opportunity and a bit of a waste of time. There were other issues we should be talking about. I'm less sure than you are that These are issues that require a synod. What they need is episcopal backbone, which appears to be the scarcest resource in the universe.
There are issues that would be nice to have a synod address. A lot of issues that we don't face in the West. Mm-hmm. What do you do with families where the husband has more than one wife, mm-hmm. and then they get the husband decides to get baptized? Mm-hmm. What is his obligation to those other wives?
That actually segues to a point that is in your piece, Sam. Are there moral obligations on the part of the person in the, let's just say, anomalous situation?
Well, that is becoming less and less anomalous.
Well, but you know, I'm trying to be diplomatic again. Yeah. But
canonically, a regular situation.
Yeah.
I see what you did there. Yeah. No, I mean, so I mean, what do you do in this kind of situation that Mike is talking about?
That's what I don't know. I mean, my inclination is to make sure that we have well-formed pastors out there, mm-hmm. who can look at those situations and decide. You know, mm-hmm. do we want to say this person who contracted a marriage, mm-hmm. the first time around, you know, got divorced, then married someone else, mm-hmm. has two kids with that next spouse, mm-hmm. you know, has a house with that person, has lived with them for 10 years? Do we want to say, look, if you want to come back to communion, you need to leave that person? Mm-hmm. Even though, if they do leave that person, they leave them in a horrible, horrible situation. Mm-hmm. They negatively impact the children, they negatively impact the spouse, and basically consign them to a much lower quality of life, and may indeed cause those people to leave the Catholic Church entirely, mm-hmm. understandably. You know, what do we do in that circumstance? I have no idea, and I don't pretend to know.
Is a near hypothetical, but only just. What do you do in the case of a 3 or more way wedding, in which 3 people quote unquote marry one another
at the same time?
At the same time,
right. None of those marriage are valid from a Christian marriage perspective.
So why is that not the answer to your point about the Ugandan?
Because the Ugandan situation,
pre-baptism,
it's a. The church recognizes there's marriage as a sacrament, but there's also natural marriage. And natural marriage is not sacramental, but it is something that is recognized as being a thing. And natural marriages have in the past and can be in societies plural marriages. And so in that situation of the, you know, someone from Uganda who was involved in a plural marriage and then is baptized, there is a question of legitimate obligation. If you have a case of someone who was part of a fundamentalist Latter-day Saints church out in Utah, and then they leave and decide to come back into the Catholic Church. If they come into the Catholic Church and decide to get married, none of those marriage would be valid because they don't have at all the same concept of marriage that we do. Hmm. That would be my argument there. It's the same reason why we don't recognize their baptism, because their concept of that is so radically different.
We don't recognize Mormon baptism?
We do not recognize Mormon baptism.
I thought the only baptisms we didn't recognize were the Nazarene and some
non-Trinitarians.
We do not. Mormons are not Trinitarian.
Yeah.
You know, God bless Reddit. I had a conversation on this point on Reddit with a Mormon who was asking if their baptisms were valid, and my question was, well, so you baptize using water, yeah. Do you use a Trinitarian formula? No. Oh, okay, yeah, that would be a problem. Out of curiosity, what do you say? I baptize you in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. That's a Trinitarian formula.
The intent.
So the intent is missing.
The intent is
missing. If you look at the LDS website, discover for yourself what they say about the Trinity.
Keeping in mind that when I look at this, I may regret saying this, but if it's invalid by reason of a defect in intent, because their understanding of what they're saying is quite different to what we would understand. Why is a Baptist baptism valid, given that they also have a radically different understanding? They don't think that they are effectuating a sacramental sign that's going to wash away original sin. But we still hold that to be valid because they use the right words and they use the right matter and form.
Because the defect in intent, mm-hmm, for Mormons and for other non-Trinitarians is in their understanding of God. Mm. Is they don't understand that to God to be three in one. Mm. Jesus is not the same as the Father in terms of his Godhead. Mm. Neither is the Holy Spirit.
So they're semi-Aryan? Is that the idea?
Kinda. Okay. Except a lot more weirder. I hate to say that.
Look, you can say that any religion that's against coffee is weird.
Well, within the normal Christian understanding, the traditional understanding of the Trinity, they're really out there. They're off the mark, and so that's where the defect arises. You can make an argument that because the Baptists don't understand sacraments, that that doesn't count. But the Catholic Church has decided that this and marriage are the two sacraments that we will recognize, even if they don't fully understand what's being done. The grace of God is there, and there's sufficient intent to count. At least, the Baptists understand that it's something that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't call it a sacrament, they have another name for it that's...
Ordinance.
Ordinance. Thank you. Yeah, they'll call it, for a lot of them, that's an ordinance. That's something that's required.
Yeah, it was required for me when I was going to the Assembly of God Church. Now, I got to decide when I wanted to be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
That was a free choice on my part. But that was certainly something that was required.
Going back to your point, Sam, about this just reaffirming the situation on the ground.
Yeah.
Isn't that a significant setback?
That would be exactly my concern with it.
In the sense that we have to fight the same old battles, yes.
But, I mean, it's worse. Because, I mean, before, the people were disobedient.
Right.
Either on different levels. But we could point and say, well, we all know what Rome says. Mm-hmm. And now they have cover a mile long.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have the fortified position on the hill anymore.
Yeah, we're
fighting on the open plain.
Yeah, we're out in the wilderness.
That's why I didn't find Father Hunwick's suspense point terribly convincing, because one can make the argument that at the time of the Arian crisis, it was a legitimate open question, in a way that it wouldn't be if you had Neo-Arians today. No, I don't like prefixes like that, but if you had a Neo-Arian today, a Neo-Arian movement within the church, the result would be we would just easily point back and say, look, this is over and done with, we've settled this many, many times over the years, done. There's something qualitatively different about it, and he kind of acknowledges this in saying that this is an issue that has been thought closed and now reopened. It's not, mm-hmm, quite, the idea that we are now in suspense as to what the outcome of what the church teaches is going to be. It's different if the question is reopened, as you say, rather than...
That's not how I understood his piece.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, from what I read about his piece, he's saying that the church knew what the truth was. It wasn't a question of what is truth. Mm-hmm. The church knew what the truth was, but failed to enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
But failed to carry it out. Which is why whenever the church once again started to enforce it, they removed heretical bishops from the roles and things like that.
I don't know if that was actually done, but that seems like a poor move.
Yeah.
Given how important the episodic succession is.
I agree. That's not removing people from the roles. It's not something that I would support.
So what do you want
moving
to do?
Moving them from their C's is a different
thing. Yeah, do you want to put an asterisk next to their names?
Look, if we can call, you know...
put some highlighter over it?
I say, if you put an asterisk next to the name of every heretical bishop on the rolls, it would look like soft snow.
we'll just start adding names to it. You know, Casper the Simoner.
That's old school, but
That's what I'll. That's what we should do.
Yeah.
You know, if we can call
Marx the Schismatic.
If we can call Gregory Great, and if we can call Saint John Paul Great, mm-hmm. then we can call Casper the Simoner.
Okay.
Then we can call. We should.
What are we going to call Saint Marcel Lefebvre?
I'm gonna call them a schismatic.
Okay.
The stubborn.
the stubborn is I like that you're going along with my premise that he's gonna be a saint.
I'm not calling him a saint. No.
I thought I'd smuggled that one past you.
No, I'm not calling him a saint. I'm definitely not. The disobedient.
Yeah, actually that's probably fair.
That's the reason why I can't get behind that movement.
Hmm.
Is because they are still disobedient.
I have other issues with them. One is the heresy hunting.
Mm-hmm.
The finding heresy in everything tendency.
Mm-hmm.
That is incredibly irritating to me as somebody who's mm-hmm. been a heretic. I know that line. I have crossed that line back and forth many times. And their tendency to find heresy in Benedict XVI or John Paul II.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not strictly an SSP-10 thing. I've decided that I'm going to start calling it SSP-10 and SSP-5 because it's a Roman numeral, for Pete's sake. I know we call it OSX, but it should be OS-10.
It takes the cool factor out of it, though.
No, I like that. Yeah. But
that's what I say is that's an SSP-5 thing. That's a study of Kansas thing, not an SSP-10
thing.
I don't think that
those lines are a little blurry sometimes.
Yeah,
Simon.
You're probably right.
I have heresy hunting as a flaw. It's a flaw that I'll call out, but it's a flaw that I can tolerate.
A lot more than the disobedience.
Because the heresy hunting, especially calling out Benedict XVI or John Paul the Great, comes out of disobedience. If they were obedient, then they might think that, but they'd think twice about saying it so publicly unless they were absolutely sure.
You know, there are things that Benedict and John Paul did that you are a lot more well disposed towards John Paul particularly than I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that the things for which I fault him were not in any way heretical.
Yeah,
right. They were pastoral.
Yeah, I think I'm probably much more likely than you are to say he was asleep at the switch, indeed actively an obstacle with regard to the sex abuse crisis.
Yeah,
things like the Maesia thing,
the abuse crisis, the Legionnaires. Yeah, I mean, of course, that was towards the end of his pontificate, whenever he was suffering from the advanced stages of Parkinson's.
No, I mean, there were things going back into the early 80s, and John Paul, as I understand it, had a... I mean, this is really a whole different topic, but John Paul was inclined to think that the right solution to problematic priests was to give them responsibilities so that they could work through them and be productive in a way that, in hindsight, looks nutty. I'm sure at the time... It's very easy to look back and say, well, this should have been done, this should have been done.
Yeah.
I think that attitude towards what you're calling heresy hunting is much broader than SSP-10. I'm just going to call it SSP-X. That attitude is, I think, quite pervasive in... It was a good idea. I tried it.
It worked for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
We had a good run.
Yeah. We had a good run. So that is a broader problem, I think, in the traditionalist Catholic movement, what I would call the Orthodox Catholic movement, maybe we'll talk about that in a moment, toward creating a synthetic orthodoxy that didn't exist at the beginning of Vatican II.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of open questions at the start of Vatican II on which people could have all sorts of views, and did have all sorts of views. And I sometimes worry that that Orthodox Catholics are too keen to conflate their specific, usually quite Marian-focused version of it with... You know, I mean, I am acutely aware of the irony that by the standards of the Catholic Church I would like to sing into being, I would be a wild-eyed liberal, way out on the left edge, because I'm a Marian minimalist and I don't have a lot of... patience with a lot of the kind of the devotional structures that they have in mind.
You'd be a half step away from being a Protestant,
right? Exactly. Yeah. But you know but none of the positions I take would be actually against what the Church teaches. But they kind of almost want to collapse the or to create this kind of synthetic, extended. Like an extended universe in Star Wars. We talked about Star Wars earlier. You know, if you're violating the canon on screen, that's a problem. But if you're violating an extended universe novel, meh.
So, ladies and gentlemen, the mediatrix of all graces is part of the extended universe.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, that's the courtship of Princess Mary. No. But yeah, I mean that's exactly right. I mean that the mediatrix of all graces is not dogmatically required by the Church. You could be a perfectly good Catholic in the 19 indeed you could be a perfectly good Catholic in the early 1950s and not believe in the Assumption. It's only after that was defined that that it was a settled pole star. But that was an open question. I mean, it was if you take out your trusty copy of Ludwig Ott, who I think almost everyone in SSPX would accept as a pretty good authority. It doesn't say that it's Dei Fidei, and so yeah, that kind of over certainty about what is required is something that I do see, and I don't see it as being just restricted to SSPX. I mean, you see it also in people. Even who are associated with FSSP, and really, and you know, the strands that I identified in my piece overlap, and so you do see people whom I would consider to be conservative Catholics, who are way overconfident in what they think the Church teaches. You know, they may well say, oh yeah, you absolutely must believe that Mary is the mediatrix of all graces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's generally more confusion on their part about what's Dei Fidei and what's at a lower level of Church teaching.
Yeah. That starts to get into a problem with the conservative Catholic paradigm that it is quite positivist and it's uncomfortable with different levels of Church teaching. It's often kind of difficult and messy to answer those kinds of questions. It's not like with the Supreme Court, where you can say, okay, here's a per curiam opinion, here is a fully signed opinion, here is something that was dismissed as improvidently granted, here is review. Well, you have clean, well understood, defined, precise categories, and you can put everything into a nice, neat, tidy box. And Americans expect nice, neat, tidy boxes. And when you say, well, it's complicated, then people say, it's in the magisterium, that's good enough. It's Catholic. I don't need any modifier for that, it's just Catholic. And so, you know, you kind of get that vibe from people like Carl Keating and people whom trads would call neo-Catholics and whom I would call conservative Catholics.
Yeah. Do you want to kind of explain briefly your taxonomy of...
Yeah.
Of Catholics, so that people know what you're talking about?
This is an essay that I wrote that began with an analogy in The Remnant that tried to define what they mean by terms like neo-Catholic and neo-conservative, which are terms that I really dislike, even though I will point out that George Weigel used to go around calling himself a neo-conservative Catholic. I have a book in which he defends the neoconservative difference. But that was written before Dick Cheney became the vice president and the word acquired different connotations. But they outlined what they meant by these terms. And I thought that the delineation that they were proposing, which is essentially that there are three different responses to Vatican II, was pretty good. And I didn't like the labels, which we'll come back to in a moment. But essentially their argument was that coming out of Vatican II, you had three distinctive I think they use the term factions, although my piece uses a more friendly word, strands, which is actually a nod to one of the essays in the Anglican book that we talked about last time. There's the very last one in there uses the word strands of Anglican thought. Mm. And I liked that because it's neutral. Factions seems pretty tough, and parties seems pretty tough, and there are weaker words as well, but strands seem to fit in the middle. And the idea was that coming out of the council, you had a group that wanted to stick its foot on the gas and forge forward as fast as possible, whom we would usually call liberal Catholics. And you had a faction, or excuse me, a strand, that completely rejected from the ground up the notion of reform at all. They just wanted to carry on doing. I think the quote from Lefebvre is something like, I've not invented anything new, I just wanted to carry on. You know, they saw Catholicism as just fine before the council and wanted to keep doing exactly what they'd been doing. And then you had a third response that kind of occupies the middle ground, that was a reaction to the excesses of, you know, the liberals, but that was basically happy with the paradigm of Vatican II, and was basically happy with the post-conciliar settlement, but they didn't want to. They were troubled by the irreligion of the liberals, probably with the intransigence of the other side. And the analogy that the remnant proposed was to what's sometimes called the Jewish Reformation, where in the early 19th century Judaism splintered into, by roughly analogous events that were kind of spread out more in time, split into what we now find familiar as Reform Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, and Conservative Judaism. And the same thing happened. You had a group that wanted to liberalize and modernize the religion. You had a group that, in reaction to this, wanted to say, nope, we don't want any part of that. We just want to keep doing exactly what we've been doing all along. And then you had a third group that was kind of stretched in between that said, yeah, you know, reform, yeah, that's good. We want to be modernizing and all that kind of stuff, but we don't want to go as far or as fast as the reformers want to go. And the remnant just kind of had this as a throwaway line. They kind of just made that analogy to the Jewish experience. But I found that almost as useful as the delineation that they were making. I really liked that analogy because I knew a little about it, just enough to be dangerous. And so then I went away and thought about it for a year and read about it for a year and finally got around to focusing on getting this thing written after Dwight Longenecker wrote an article responding to a letter to the New York Times that floated the same idea. And Longenecker wrote a piece saying, well, we really can't and shouldn't, but since we're going that way, my preferred faction is this one. And so I kind of figured, well, I guess I better get on with finishing writing this piece. And finally, after 16 months or however long, I got that done. And so essentially the paradigm that I'm proposing is that, yes, these three strands exist, and I think everyone knows that they exist, and that there's overlap between them, and by far the largest one is just normal Catholics who want to get on with Catholicing, which would be conservative Catholics. Catholic Answers Catholics. John Paul II Catholics. Yes. Vatican II Catholics. And then you have these two much smaller strands of kind of the liberals who want to press ahead, although Ross Douthat's lecture that you linked to makes the point that actually the ranks of Reformed Catholicism are much larger than we want to give credit to. And then you have, on the other side, what I would again call by analogy, the Orthodox Catholics, who are much more skeptical of Vatican II, not necessarily rejecting it, whatever that means. We can talk about that if you like, but some of them do. Yes, some of them do, but who are much more broadly skeptical of it and would rather try and just, and I think this is again a line from Chris Ferrara, who writes for The Remnant, who just want to live their lives more or less like Vatican II never happened. Which sounds kind of odd to think about living life in a way that ignores an ecumenical council, but we've had ecumenical councils, some of the Lateran councils, that have done absolutely nothing of relevance to the average Catholic in the pews, because all they've really done is promulgate canons relating to the clergy are dealing with such and such a problem, and we think this is a terrible idea, so stop that. To which I'm sure the laity responded, okay. you know, sucks to be you, Father. You know, but so that's the basic idea, that you have these three strands. I don't like the labels that we're currently using because they tend to be derogatory. And they tended to be loaded. And I don't think that we can really talk about things until we have a stable, settled, and fairly precise terminology. And I like the Jewish one. And I like the idea of adopting a taxonomy that already exists, and so the frame of reference can inform and disambiguate in difficult cases. And so, yeah, I you will have noticed I've been using this terminology without really explaining it for about a year, because it seems persuasive, and largely because I've been trying to provoke some feedback on it about why is this not the right language to use. But I really think that analogy to Judaism and Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox Catholics is both pretty clear and has the virtue of not being tendentious. You know, Reformed Jews aren't ashamed about being Reformed Jews, and I don't think there's any reason why a Reformed Catholic should feel bad about being a Reformed Catholic. But that word liberal or progressive, those are words that are loaded. You know, and particularly once you get into trads and rad trads and tradies, that just sounds offensive.
Well, it's intended to be pejorative at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing you brought up that I really appreciated, beyond the taxonomy itself, which I really liked, was that I realized why I don't fit comfortably in any of those groups.
I would say that one of the challenges with me writing this and us talking about it is that you and I are the marginal cases. Like, we are the boundary cases.
Yeah, I think Mike, as a cradle Catholic, can be just an Orthodox Catholic in a way that we can't as converts, because we bring different things to it.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I realized when you're talking about that is, fundamentally, I'm not reacting to Vatican II. That's what differentiates me from most of these people. You know, I'm not saying Vatican II was good and let's get on with Catholicing. Mm-hmm. I'm also not saying Vatican II was either, you know, suspicious or terrible and we ought to reject it. And I'm also not saying, woo, let's ride the spirit of Vatican II train today. Mm-hmm. Because fundamentally, that's just not what I'm concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
I see the church as a 2,000-year-old institution. And I'm not reacting to Vatican II as if it were the seminal event of the Church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right, to me,
the conservative Catholics tend to treat it almost like a Magna Carta, and so they'll write a piece, and every reference will be to Vatican II or a post-Vatican II Pope.
Correct. And whereas I'm much more likely to say, you know, here's what Saint Justin Martyr said, and here's what Aquinas said, and here's what Saint John Paul II said.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I'm more likely to have a range of authorities that I'm looking at, a range of evidence from the magisterium over time that I'm looking at, rather than saying Vatican II was the event that I'm reacting to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, with the reason why I think a lot of conservative Catholics quote from Vatican Council II, especially conservative Catholics my age, is because that's what we were raised in. You know, all of our religious education material was made by people probably on the more reform end.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they're not on the more reform end, there was a general movement that said, we've got this council, we need to talk about it, mm-hmm. and keep on talking about it and pull from that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that, because I consider myself probably more of being along that conservative Catholic. I wouldn't place myself in the Orthodox, let's pretend VC2 never happened, let's ignore VC2. I think some good things came out of Vatican Council II. But I think that a lot of just let's get on Catholicing Catholics pull from VC2 or pull from the post-council popes, because that's what they've been exposed to. And I think we're going to see a swing. I think that we're going to see things adjust again.
where we're going to pull more from before the council, and it's going to adjust. And these aren't going to be the Orthodox or traditionalist Latin Mass only type people. These are people who will agree with the framework, but I don't think they would see Vatican Council II as being a Magna Carta. Or if they see it, that's just because that's what they were born into, rather than being a position that they've actively chosen.
What do you see two generations from now, as far as the relationship of people to Vatican Council II?
I think that there's going to be a significant coalescing between the Orthodox and the conservative movement in the church, where you'll have a lot more, you'll still have your hard lines, but you'll have a lot more regular Catholics who are more familiar with the Latin Mass, or more familiar with having Latin, especially after the reforms and how we educate our priests. And so I think there's going to be that, but there'll still be a significant reform section, and how successful the reform section is depends on the next 10 to 20 years.
I say Duffett's argument in that lecture is that we routinely underestimate the strength. And by the way, he seems to implicitly agree with the delineations that I've made. He mm-hmm. never actually says it in as many words. His lecture is entitled "The Crisis of Conservative Catholicism," and I don't think he would have needed to change a word if he had read my piece and agreed with every single word that I've put in there, mm-hmm. because it is actually a very acute diagnosis of that, either as a freestanding category or in terms of the taxonomy that I've put in there. I mean, and there are a few things in there that suggest that he kind of makes offhand reference to FSPX. That's one of the points that he makes, that we tend to underestimate how resilient Reformed Catholicism is, and that is really becoming quite apparent under Francis, that it's really kind of coming back out of the woodwork.
Well, I think that's good. I mean, I think Douthat was exactly right to note with interest that he got a letter to the editor about his piece. And I think it was fascinating to see who signed that letter.
Rogue's Gallery.
Well, it essentially says most of these people are probably Reformed Catholics. Mm-hmm. My guess is not all of them were. Mm-hmm. There were probably some other conservative Catholics who just disagreed with, you know, him taking a shot at the Pope, essentially. Now, there were probably just some papal loyalists in there, would be my guess. But my guess is that most of them were probably Reformed Catholics. And I think it's good that we just have them on record. And that, at the very least, we can say, okay, this person is a Reformed Catholic. We can have a dialogue with this person as a Reformed Catholic instead of pretending that we're all just the same kind of Catholic.
Yeah, and I think that may be part of what I am inclined to do with that piece. And I know other people may have different instincts, but I'm inclined to say, look, we are actually divided. There's no point in pretending otherwise. Mm-hmm. And we will do better to acknowledge this and be clear about what these divisions actually connote and talk about it, rather than, I mean, I think that what people have in mind is St. Paul's "have no schisms among you," and so how could we possibly divide ourselves up by having labels? And I think I say this somewhere in the piece, that I think that's nonsense. Labels don't divide, divisions divide. And if anything, refusing to acknowledge that these divisions exist deepens them, because it eliminates all possibility for dialogue if we insist on pretending that actually Marx doesn't actually disagree with Burke. Well, of course they do, and it becomes a corrupting bit of dishonesty to pretend that these people actually believe the same things.
It's a fine line. Labels help. Clearly identifying differences is better than pretending there's no differences. But at the same time, I don't want to see that filter down on the parish level, or at least that scares me.
That, you don't want those differences to harden?
Yeah, because what will happen if
I can go online and say, oh, Father so-and-so, he's a conservative. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to his church rather than going to, I hear so-and-so's a little squishy. Mm-hmm. And then before you know it, you know, I raise my children going to the conservative parish. Mm-hmm. You know, Sam raises his children going to the Orthodox
In the
parish.
Same way that we have conservative and reform synagogues.
Exactly, exactly. And that, I don't want to see that happen. The other thing that
I can see the response to this before I say it, and so I say this with trepidation, but the Anglicans were able to do that without difficulty for a couple of centuries. What has broken the Anglican communion has been other issues unrelated to, you know, the Anglican communion is not fracturing down high church, low church lines. It's fracturing on every other issue, but not those.
I am not going to model myself on a church.
I knew I was going to get pushed.
That was
that.
Look, the Anglican communion was able to hold together high church, low church, because it was held by the sword of the king. If you wanted to be a loyal Englishman, you worshipped at an Anglican church, and the king didn't care if you used bells or you sang Hare Krishna, as long as you were loyal to the king. That's what mattered.
Yeah, isn't the way Christopher Hitchens put it that it was based on the family values of Henry VIII?
Yeah, you know. So we don't have that, and that's not the purpose of church. And that kind of gets to one of the things that I absolutely abhor, is that whenever we treat religion like politics,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
there is an overlapping nature to it. But I mean, it used to be that you could be a faithful Catholic, go to church every Sunday, and not care what the cardinals in Germany were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that day to come again. People on the internet roll their eyes at the faithful Catholics who are in love with Francis.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're naive, because they're not paying attention. But good for them. You know, if they can get by, they can be a very faithful Catholic and not pay attention to what's going on, and they're probably better for it.
This is probably a question for another day, because we're running a little long, but let me ask the question and maybe we'll ponder it and come back and talk about it in the next one. It's a bit of next week. To what extent do you have something similar going on in the Democratic Party? It used to be that a Democrat in New York was a happy camper, and knew his Democrat friends, and they all voted for the Democrat candidates, and they were all pretty happy. And they neither knew nor cared that down in deepest, darkest Alabama, there was a guy who also called himself a Democrat, who believed completely different things, things that they would find abhorrent, and he also went around as a happy camper, voting for Democratic candidates, and all this kind of stuff, blissfully unaware that or at least unconcerned that there were people in New York who had views that were utterly abhorrent to him, and they all happily voted for the same presidential candidate because the presidential candidate was a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a Democrat. They, you know, the New York Democrats were Democrats and the Southern Democrats were Democrats, and the fact that they believed completely different and irreconcilable things was of no concern to anyone because they didn't know.
They knew. At least the party leadership knew, and the anyone who held office knew. But it was the Democratic Party and its majority is a unique set of circumstances. The Democrats held the South because the South wasn't going to vote Republican. You know, that's the entire reason, and the South was willing to vote against everything else, as long as they're not voting for Republicans.
I think there was something about a war.
Yeah. We had some hard feelings. We lost a football game or something. I take our football very seriously. And, you know, that became less of an issue. You also have a situation where
part. You thought just because you'd beaten the Redskins, you could beat the Patriots. It did not work out.
you also have issues in the parties where parties used to be a lot more powerful than they were before. You were willing to compromise on ideological things because the party could get you stuff, mm-hmm. like political positions, highway funding, and stuff like that. Parties can't do that nearly as much anymore. We have laws against that stuff. PACs have more powers now. And, you know, Congress, the ability of Congress to put in earmarks has been curtailed in recent years. Mm. And so as parties become less powerful, the people within the parties have the luxury to pursue ideological purity. Mm. If the party system was more powerful, we would see less ideological purity because people have a greater incentive to work with people they disagree with.
We should probably end on that because we're now at 1:50 second podcast we're recording. Wow. Say nothing of the half hour we did on the first one. And also, my wife's going to kill me.
So. Well, Simon, it's been a pleasure doing our last podcast.
Yes.
That's right.
I'll sing at your funeral.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'd just like to point out that if I get this out in reasonable time, we're going to scoop the Star Wars franchise with Episode 7.
Yeah.
We'll call this one The Force Awakens, or possibly The First Awakens, since we've talked about First Amendment stuff. So,
I like it.
Who was it who put out for a while that everyone knew what Guns N' Roses' new album was going to be called? And so someone put out an album called that title, You Snooze, You Lose.
That's funny.